I'd like to invite Dr. Nazgul Ghadnoush up here. Dr. Ghadnoush is a research analyst at the Sentencing Project. She analyzes racial disparities in incarceration, trends in public opinion about punishment and sentencing policies. We in the United States today incarcerate more people proportionally than any country in the world. Can you explain to me how we got here?
Well, a really common statistic is that the U.S. has 5% of the world's population, but over 20% of the world's prisoners. We actually didn't used to always be in this situation. So until the prison population started to increase in the 1970s, our rate of incarceration was similar to our peer countries, and it's no longer. So right now, we have nine times as high a rate of incarceration as Germany, five times as high as England. And one thing that we've learned that actually researchers have been telling us throughout these decades of prison boom is that the relationship between crime and incarceration is not as clear as we think that it is. Some people might think that rising crime rates is what brought us here, and it's actually not. Crime rates did go up, and it did cause a fear that elected officials were reacting to and that the public was worried about. But crime rates have been going down for the past 20 years, but incarceration rates have not been. Something else that researchers know is that another way that crime and incarceration are not related as closely as we would like is that the more we incarcerate, we achieve diminishing returns in terms of reducing crime rates. So some of the best estimates are incarceration levels have reduced crime rates by something between 5 to 25%. And they've come at a huge cost, not just at the cost of putting someone behind bars, but really destroyed the lives of a lot of people and a lot of communities.
Okay, thank you. Now, sitting to my left, I have Eric Smith here. He is the supervisory special agent, the Kansas City District Office, supervising a group of local, state, and federal drug investigators and task forces based here in Kansas City and also in Jefferson City. So, Eric, you just heard what was said about the concept of incarceration. Did what you observe conform with what you just heard, and do you think we're making progress, or do you think we're going backwards?
Well, I acknowledge what she said, and the statistics I would say are accurate. One thing I'd like to point out, and a distinction that I'd like to make, is the disproportionate number of prison inmates in the federal system who are drug offenders. And I'd like to draw a distinction between the label of drug offender and drug trafficker. But I think that's very important for people who participate in this conversation to understand that difference. The statistic I wrote down and brought with me today, and that is roughly 48.7%, almost half of the federal inmates in federal prison are incarcerated for drug offenses. That's about 95,000 prisoners. Those are drug traffickers. They're not merely drug possessors. They're not merely drug users. And I think that nuance gets lost sometimes in this conversation. The undertone of this conversation really, in my opinion, has a lot to do with the mass number of drug offenders as opposed to predatory sex offenders or violent criminals. Are drug offenders being sentenced disproportionately? The people that are in prison who have been charged and convicted for federal drug violations are charged and convicted and sentenced for violating federal drug trafficking statutes, not possession statutes. There's only one drug possession statute in the federal system, and that calls for a penalty of less than 1 year in prison, and more commonly, a civil penalty and a civil violation. So the people who are incarcerated for federal drug offenses are traffickers.
If I were to say to you, what is the minimum amount of activity to qualify to be charged as a drug trafficker, what is that?
Well, by statute, there is no threshold. But in practice, there are thresholds that trigger minimum mandatory sentencing. And in most of the 90-some-odd federal judicial districts across the United States, the U.S. Attorney's Office matches their prosecution thresholds with the minimum mandatory thresholds. And in some large, very populous, and very busy districts, they'll raise their own thresholds far above and beyond what the trigger is for a minimum mandatory. So just to give you an example, how much marijuana would have to be involved in a federal prosecution before somebody would trigger the 10-year minimum mandatory. 1 ton of marijuana in a conspiracy in a federal investigation is what's required to trigger the 10-year minimum mandatory prison term.
What about crack cocaine?
Well, crack cocaine, actually, just within the last 2 years, the disparity has been reduced for a 10-year minimum mandatory. It used to be 28 grams. I'm not sure what it was reduced to, but it was moved a lot closer to the powder cocaine, which was disparate, and that was 1,000 grams or 1 kilogram.
Okay. Let's expand the conversation here. I'd like to get Dr. Michael Gilbert. He's a professor with the University of Texas, San Antonio. He's the executive director of the National Association of Community and Restorative Justice. And I'd also like to ask Joan Blades to join us up here. Joan is the co-founder of MoveOn.org and Living Room Conversations. She authored a piece with Grover Norquist on reforming the criminal justice system for Time Magazine. You've listened to what the two other panelists have had to say. Mike, what's your observation, particularly on what Eric just said?
Well, I think we approach it somewhat differently. The approach that Eric is talking about is a criminal justice approach to what is essentially a non-criminal justice problem. That is, drug dependency in our society is not going to be amenable to criminal justice solutions. You can think of it this way. Most of us know that tobacco is terribly habit-forming, but we have the lowest use rates right now in terms of tobacco than we ever have. Tobacco is right up there with the major drugs in terms of its ability to produce a dependency that's very hard to break, and I think most of you who are smokers probably have found that to be true. Yet we have this low rate of tobacco use. So how did we get there? Did we lock up the users? Did we penalize the producers? Did we go after the traffickers? And the answer is we did none of that. What we did do is that we treated the problem with health and education policy, which is what it really is. Substance abuse and substance dependency can be addressed with health and education policy, but it cannot be addressed in a meaningful way using criminal justice policy. Criminal justice policy will arrest and lock up lots of people. It will not stop the problem of drug dependency or drug distribution in our society. And I think that's something that the evidence is becoming clearer and clearer as time goes on. So I think we have to think better about this problem.
Okay, thank you. And Joan, welcome up here. And when I mentioned earlier, Joan wrote an article with Grover Norquist for Time Magazine on this subject. And Joan, why don't you explain how this all came about?
Well, as a founder of Move On, I've had the last 15 years excessive exposure to partisan politics. And my inclination has actually been towards finding common ground. And finding common ground is what I think is most important for our problem solving going forward. And that, in fact, when we work together, we're going to be able to come up with much better solutions. And a couple years ago, I had a living room conversation I co-hosted with Mark Meckler, co-founder of Tea Party Patriots. And so in my living room, I had a conversation with Mark and his friends and my friends about crony capitalism. And that was the point at which I really got solid on the fact that there's an incredible amount of agreement across partisan lines that the criminal justice system needs reforming, that there are too many people in prison. We need to start using evidence-based practices in terms of dealing with people that are in the system, and that the war on drugs has been a failure. And that's something that I'm getting the impression that we could really work together on in a successful way. Yesterday, I saw in the New York Times that presidential hopefuls from right and left are talking about criminal justice reform as one of these things that we can do. So I find that very exciting.
No, I think that things obviously are changing. Mike, I want to go back to you for a second. What would you suggest that someone in Eric's position to do, okay? I mean, this gentleman has a responsibility as an officer of the United States government is to carry out the law. So would you say that the way that his agency is carrying out the law is appropriate? Is it inappropriate? What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, Eric is a federal employee. He's an officer of the government. He is responsible for carrying out the law as it is written. And I would expect him to honor that. But that should not dissuade us from understanding that the mission that has been given to that agency is flawed. We can't keep drugs out of a nation, and people say, well, can you keep it out of a prison? Well, I've worked in prisons for 12 years straight through. We can't keep it out. So if you can't keep it out of a prison, how are you going to keep it out of a nation? And the question then is well, what's going to work to reduce incarceration and reduce drug problems in our society? What's going to work is not what we've been doing. And we're spending huge amounts of money on these problems. Yet we're no closer to really seeing a drug-free America.
Let me go back to Eric for a second here. And I just want to sort of say, you indicated that there's prosecutorial discretion in deciding to bring someone up as a drug trafficker or not. And once you're a drug trafficker, you're flipping into a minimum mandatory sentence of 10 years. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay. Do you think that if you are in a different part of the country, of a different racial background, of a different age, it changes? In other words, there is this notion of we're all supposed to be equal under the law. Do you think that's the case?
There are probably noticeable differences across the 90-some federal judicial districts within the U.S. Attorney's Office in terms of where they place that threshold at and what they're willing to prosecute. When you talk about somebody who's committed a crime allegedly that reaches that threshold and triggers that minimum mandatory, there are other factors that go into a judge's discretion than even to sentence in a minimum mandatory case. For example, a violator who's been convicted of a minimum mandatory offense who does not have a prior criminal history and did not commit that crime while armed with a firearm and various other aggravating factors, they would be eligible under sentencing guidelines for what's called safety valve relief. So the judge can depart downwards in situations like that, and I think it's important to understand the differences between the offenders who are sentenced to the minimum mandatory versus those who are eligible for safety valve relief. There is a lot of discretion within the U.S. Attorney's Office resting with the prosecutors as to whether or not they trigger an enhancement based on prior federal drug trafficking convictions.
Right.
They have the discretion whether to pull that trigger and double that minimum mandatory or whether they don't. So it's not just an enforcement issue. It's a discretion issue that rests with the prosecutor's office and to some extent even with the judiciary.
I think we have a question here. Nick.
The first question, have mandatory sentencing guidelines at state and federal levels increased incarceration rates that would not have otherwise increased?
Well, I'm going to let Yaskel take a shot at that.
Sure, I'd be happy to take a shot with that. So what does explain the situation is first the war on drugs, which we've been discussing, so increased enforcement. And second is the greater likelihood of sending people to prison across all kinds of offenses. So whereas in the past people would have gotten community supervision like probation, they're now more often sent to prison. And third, they're given longer sentences for all kinds of offenses. So that's where mandatory minimums comes in. I wanted to go back and respond to some of Eric's points. I think I agree with much of what he said. The first point about that drug traffickers, or I would call them drug sellers, are a significant proportion of people that are in prison for drug offenses. That's especially true in the federal system, which has about 200,000 prisoners. It's even more true in the state systems, which have about 1.3 million prisoners. So that's important to keep the distinction in terms of the size and scale of these two different systems. So most people that are in prison for a drug offense are there for selling, But it's also the case that people are there for property offenses and other kinds of crimes, and these crimes are a result of untreated addictions that had we used more of a public health approach to address these problems, they might not be going to prison for those kinds of offenses. And it's also true that a lot of people are going to prison for violating the conditions of their community supervision, and drug arrests have a lot to do with that. And if I could just say one more thing, on race, we know that some communities get a lot more enforcement than others, and I often like to give the example of college campuses. If you were a Freddie Gray, who recently was killed in Baltimore, and we know all about his rap sheet because of him being very much under the spotlight now, arrests for possession of marijuana and possession with apparent intent to sell of other kinds of drugs, if he were on a college campus, he wouldn't have that rap sheet, because there is just not that kind of surveillance on most college campuses. And it's important when we think about racial disparities that we think about how drug laws are enforced at the community level by police officers, by not just discretion, but police policies that dictate greater enforcement in low-income communities of color. And there are also studies that show even when you control for all of these factors, like criminal histories, like the severity of the offense, people of color are, especially because of the discretion of prosecutors, they are charged more harshly than white Americans. So these are important racial disparities to be aware of.
Okay, Nick, you have got another
question. Yes, lots of questions coming in, Alan. The campaign to reduce drug use through the schools, DARE, has been notably unsuccessful, according to this questioner. Why do you think social policy will change the rate of drug use?
Mike, why don't you take a shot at that?
If you look around the world and you say, where can I find some of the lowest drug use rates? Some of them are in countries that are treating drug use and drug problems very differently. Portugal has decriminalized just about every form of drug for use. It's still illegal to do drug transactions, but enforcement is no longer focused on the user. It's focused on treatment. And so users are afforded an opportunity to get into treatment that is federally supported and funded. And so use rates have gone down rather dramatically in Portugal. The question then becomes, well, where do you have more control? Do you have more control in a criminalized environment, or do you have more control in a legalized environment? And I'll just give you a quick anecdote about how you can think about that. In San Antonio, I work with the police department regularly, and I work with the police academy there as a trainer, and I've been in meetings where one officer was talking about a drug case where they were staking out a location, watching a dealer, and up comes this six-year-old kid. He walks straight up to the dealer and makes a buy, and he walks home. And so they kind of watch where the kid goes, and they figure out where his home is. And a little while later, they go around the backside and they knock on the door, and sure enough, he's made a drug buy for his mom. And my question is this: could that same six-year-old kid take 20 bucks and go buy a beer at the local Stop and Go? Could that same kid go buy cigarettes? What's the difference? And what gives us control and what doesn't give us control? And what doesn't give us control is prohibition. So if you really want to exercise control, you have to think differently about this problem.
Thank you. Nick.
We were talking about other countries. There's a question about that, Alan. Indonesia has been in the news lately regarding their recent execution of 8 drug traffickers, though against international condemnation of the harsh sentences. But what are your thoughts? Effective as a deterrence?
Sure.
My personal opinion is no, it's not an effective deterrent. Much like, and I'm going to step out on a limb here, but much like capital punishment is probably not a proven effective deterrent for homicide. It's a social response, it's a governmental accountability response to that act, but not necessarily an effective deterrent.
Want to jump in on that?
That's right, it's not an effective deterrent because most people that break the law don't expect to get caught. And so if you enhance penalties, most people think they're smart enough to get away with it. And in fact, most people get away with their crimes. We catch a small proportion of people that are committing crimes. And One thing I would add to that is that often when we make these international comparisons and think, well, isn't it great that we're doing better than that country? We are doing better than Indonesia. We're not executing people for drugs, for selling drugs. But we are sending them to prison for life. So we're not killing them, but we're sending them to prison to die.
Okay, I want to insert one more thing into this conversation here. And I'm going to start with you, Joan. According to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, 1 in 17 white men will be incarcerated sometime in their life. If you're a black man, it's 1 in 3. If you're a Latino, it's 1 in 6. Now, as one of our speakers at our lunchtime said today, unless you believe, if you're African-American or if you're Latino, that you have this sort of crime gene in you, which I think most people would argue that's probably not the case, how do we explain what's going on out there, Joan, and what do we do about it?
From the reading I've done, the best explanation is that there is a great deal more investigation, searches of people of color. And, you know, one of the statements made was, you know, if they enforced the marijuana laws in colleges like they do in certain parts of the inner city, we'd have jails filled with college students. And I tend to think there may be some truth to that, because my understanding is that the usage of drugs is about equal, and in fact even a little less among communities of color. I also think a huge amount of this is poverty, because people that have the means to deal with being pulled over, being caught, you know, we've seen that poverty is a huge risk factor for ending up in prison. You can end up in prison from having tickets, which is horrendous, honestly.
So, Eric, one could draw on a conclusion that communities of color are targeted more. Do you think that's a fair comment?
I don't think that's fair, at least from my perspective and from the job that I do. Our targets, if you want to use that phrase, are selected based on where the crime is occurring. I'll use the two different enforcement groups that I supervise as an example. I supervise an enforcement group out in Jefferson City, Missouri, and predominantly the defendants that office targets and seeks to prosecute are not people of color. However, as they develop their investigations in terms of sources of supply and drug trafficking organizations and cartels, you can imagine what the racial demographic will become. The methamphetamine, the heroin, the cocaine sources of supply are usually Hispanic or Latin in origin, and so those cartels are the ones who are going to be targeted.
Okay. Anyone else want to jump on the mic?
Use patterns between people of means and people of poverty are very, very different. The use patterns of people in poverty tend to expose them to police observation, not necessarily DEA observation, but certainly municipal and city police observation. The typical user who is poor has very little money to spend at any given time. They will buy small amounts that are used very quickly and often out in the open. A middle-class user, they don't typically go to an open-air drug market. Where they make their buys is they call a friend who calls a friend who calls a friend, and about 3 hours later, ding-dong, you have pizza, but it's not pizza. That is extremely hard for police to catch. And so consequently, what local police in particular do catch are the people who are using in the high-risk way. Additionally, upper middle class and more wealthy people only buy 2 or 3, 4 times a year because they take it home and they store it. But poor people who buy drugs don't oftentimes have good places to store what they buy. So they buy in small amounts and they use it quickly. And that, by the way, increases the potential for dependency, because dependency is not related to the drug itself. Dependency is related to the use rate and how frequently you redose. If all you do is redose once every 2 weeks, you're never really going to develop a good, strong dependency. But if you redose every other day, your dependency is going to be full-blown very, very quick. So you think about poor people using very quickly, buying more frequently, using so that they don't lose their drugs. They become to the attention of police very quickly.
I would just add that two points. First, in enforcing drug laws, we're generally not getting the, who's the character from the TV show that's making meth? The Walter Whites. We're getting much lower level people than that. And much of the research shows that people use drugs at similar rates and they buy drugs from people of the same race as them. So the prison population for drug offenses should mirror the overall population. But I want to just shift the conversation a little bit away from drugs to talk about other kinds of crimes as well. One of the hard truths is that there are differential rates of crimes. If you look at homicide rates, for example, African American, especially young men, have much higher homicide rates than white young men. And that has to do a lot with what Joan mentioned earlier, which is that they experience higher rates of poverty, experience higher rates of concentrated poverty. And when people live in conditions like that and you throw in guns, then it's a very volatile situation. So both of these things are true, which is that we have underlying conditions that produce different crime rates for certain kinds of crimes, and we have a system that suffers from disparities that are created as a result of discretion and our policies.
Nick, I think you've got a fact check.
We do have fact checkers from our UMKC libraries, and coordinating it all for us is Stephen Lockton. Okay, what have we got?
We had a fact check come in pertaining to a claim that Michael Gilbert had made, and it was on the fact that drug usage did not diminish in Portugal.
Okay, and did it?
It did not, but we found that drug deaths did drop 5 years later after those drugs were decriminalized in 2001 from 400 deaths to 299 per year, and that is out of the Cato Institute.
The last time we had a question from the floor, it related to Indonesia executing drug traffickers. Let's follow up on that. Is there another country or society that has successfully addressed high incarceration or drug issues that are similar to the United States? Please explain what they did, if so.
Okay, who wants to take this first shot of that one? Mike, you want to start it?
Well, I guess the answer is I'm going to confess ignorance here. I can't think of another country that even approaches what we do. If you put the incarceration rates of countries in terms of number of people incarcerated, it's U.S. first, China second. But if you put the incarceration rates up there in terms of just the rates, it's the U.S. first, then it's Russia second. China goes completely off the chart because they have 5.5 times as many people as we do, and per capita, that's a much lower rate than it is in terms of what it would be in our country. I don't know of any other country that has this kind of approach to criminal justice that we have. We are an outlier. Very clear, there's no country in the world that does what we do on these issues.
Let me just sort of broaden this conversation a little. Some of the statistics that we've looked at indicate the large number of people who are incarcerated who suffer from mental illness. Who wants to talk about why we got there? Joan, you got some thoughts on that?
I have read enough to say that it's my impression that we have somewhere between 10 and 30% mentally ill people in our prisons, and that has been the alternative we've ended up with as we've failed to have mental health services that are sufficient for our population. And drug use and mental illness are intertwined. So in some ways, it's a hard place to really say, well, this person's mentally ill, this person has a drug problem. I've really come to see them both as health problems. And I think if we were to start looking at them that way in a more holistic sense, we'd be doing a lot better.
Eric, according to the Bureau of Justice statistics, that there are estimated 705,000 mentally ill adults are incarcerated in state prisons, 78,800 in federal prisons. In your experience, do you see that some of the crimes are the manifestations of mental illness, or do you see the reverse, or don't you see it at all?
Well, I think I see it to the extent that Joan mentioned, in that mental illness and drug use are often intertwined. I wanted to address one of the points that Dr. Gilbert made earlier, and I wanted to frame it in the context of the anecdote that he described about the little six-year-old that bought from the drug dealer. I agree with him totally and wholeheartedly that the problem of drug addiction cannot be approached from an enforcement perspective. We're on the same page there. But take the situation that he described. If we're going to approach it as a public health issue, and we're going to spend our vast resources attacking addiction and trying to prevent addiction, what then are we to do with the person in that crack house who, for the sole motivation of greed, seeks to thwart the new policy by pushing the addiction? What is our response to them? And I get my plug in here because that's what the mission of the DEA is. And perhaps even states at some level can try to model new policies after that approach. But our mission is to attack the trafficker. While we may choose as a society, as a matter of public policy, to treat addiction and to treat drug use as a public health issue, what are we to do, and I ask to stimulate conversation, what are we to do with the people who try to undermine that policy?
Well, trafficking is a function of the legal definition of the substance that is being trafficked. If the substance is alcohol in its 1920s and 1930s, if you're a bootlegger, you're a trafficker. And you're bootlegging beer and your wine and alcohol, you're a trafficker. And on January 6, 1920, prohibition went into effect. And people were partying like crazy that day, trying to drink up everything they could. And before midnight on January 7th, they were not criminal. But once midnight hit, they became criminal. Their behavior did not change. It was the law that changed. So it's the legal definition that we have to be aware of and understand. When prohibition was repealed, the same bootleggers, the same people who were then the traffickers were basically put out of business because it now became legal to have that business. Now, do we still have problems with alcohol? Yes. Do we still have people who are dependent on alcohol? Absolutely. But would we be better off if we criminalized alcohol again? If, in fact, we want a low-use society, and if, in fact, we want to keep the traffickers from trafficking, I would argue that the way you get them out of business is you take the business directly away from them. And the way you take the business directly away from them is you legalize and regulate, just like you've gotten used to pharmaceuticals, alcohol, we've gotten used to tobacco being regulated. We adopt very similar kinds of regulatory structures, and that approach will essentially put the traffickers out of business. Now, they'll still be criminals, and they'll still be doing illegal things, but they won't be doing that.
Nick, you have another question for us.
Alan, so if education and reform of societal norms towards drug use might be part of the answer, and a shift towards rehabilitation in lieu of incarceration is undertaken, would mass discharge from prisons now be in order?
I would love to take this.
Well, go ahead.
So I'd like to combine this with the previous question of, you know, is there a model we can look at internationally? And we don't have any peers in terms of this level of incarceration to look at. But what we do have is, at the state level, overall, the rate of incarceration has started to go down by just a couple of percentage points in the last couple of years. So that's a really small change. And we actually did an analysis of how long it would take to get back to 1980s level of incarceration with the most recent and the largest population drop in prisons that has happened recently. It would take over 80 years. But some states have actually reduced their prison populations considerably. So New York, New Jersey, California have done the most, and they've reduced their prison populations by 25% in the past 10 or 15 years. That starts to get at the kinds of changes that we need to see. And one of the problems is that with the current really high level of incarceration that we have, it anchors the discussion so that we think we need to make some small changes when really what we need are much more significant changes. We need to reduce the prison population by much more than 25%. So for example, Newt Gingrich is advocating for 50%. All of the presidential candidates support reducing mass incarceration, and a 50% cut is of the kind of magnitude that at least we should be striving for.
Everyone in prison is not someone who was caught smoking marijuana, okay? You have some really bad people in prison. at the same time, we have states who are facing huge problems financially because of the cost of prisons and because of constitutional mandates within those states, California being one, and federal mandates as well. How do we get there? How do we? You can't just sort of say, I don't think we're going to throw the doors open and half the people get to walk out. Joan, you've done a lot in communities. How do we go about this?
Well, I will once again say I am definitely not an expert at this, but I am from California, and they have implemented having nonviolent, non-serious, non-sex offenders stay in their communities. How do we help those communities decide how to keep those people in community in a way that's good for the community? Because ultimately, you want everybody to be safer. And most people go to jail or prison for 2 to 3 years and they come back to the community they came from. The systems we have had in place aren't systems. They're like $40 and good luck. And for people that have been, you know, tightly controlled for a year or more, that's not setting them up for success. So I think the setup for success is crucial. And I see you waving over there saying, I've got things to say. You probably know much more about this than I do.
We have forgotten that most of the people who commit offenses in our society were often victims long before they were offenders. That in fact they were victimized often as children. And they have unhealed victimization in their lives. And it comes out and is expressed as offending behavior. But the secondary impacts are huge on their families in particular. And this ripples on for generation after generation if we're not careful.
I mean, Eric, you're out there with some folks that would not be necessarily described as good guys on a regular basis. If you were king, and we said, okay, which of the people you are ready to let out of jail and which people you're going to throw the key away so they never get out of jail?
That answer would span the gamut there. I think the whole reason for the criminal justice system and the whole reason for accountability is reparation to society. To be held accountable for the crimes that you commit. Let's take drug offenses off the table just for a minute and focus on the other 50% of the federal prison population. There are only 4 types of offenses that qualify or are eligible for minimum mandatory federal prison terms. Drugs is one of them, and that accounts for about 50% of the population. The others are for weapons violations, firearms offenses. Another one is for sex offenses, and the last one is for identity theft. So let's just focus on the last two, just for the sake of argument. Imagine that you were a victim or a family member of a victim of a sex offense or of an identity theft. As a citizen, what do you demand from the offender in order to repay their offense against society? To me, that's a rhetorical question because I don't know the answer and I don't have a specific in order to answer that question. But I don't think that we can forget about the segment of society that is a victim or a family member of a victim and what it is that they demand for justice.
No, I think so. And Mike, that's your area, restorative justice.
Yeah. The basic idea is, first of all, it's not restorative justice for offenders. It's restorative justice for victims. Offenders are dealt with in a way, secondarily, because it holds them accountable not to the justice system and not to the law, but to the people who have experienced the harm directly. And it asks them to be honest and to explain themselves to the people that they have harmed. And it allows the victims to be heard in a way that is not evident in the traditional court. Most victims are in a court, they are simply material witnesses. But in a restorative process, they are central to it. And what you find is that offenders oftentimes do want to own up to what they have done. But our system does not allow it. The prosecutors don't want victims talking to the offenders, and the defense counsel don't want the offenders talking to the victims. And what you find is that if you actually allow this to happen, there's healing on the part of victims because they get their questions answered. They are able to hold the individual who did this personally accountable to them. And justice is not getting a sentence and going to prison. That is not justice for victims. What is justice for victims is that you have been directly accountable to me. And that's a dimension that allows the offender to regain their humanity. to regain their position in society.
But if we think about what the goal of the criminal justice system is, one of the primary goals is to promote public safety. And when we think about the kinds of sentences that we have now, so for example, 1 in 9 prisoners are serving a life sentence with the possibility of parole and life without the possibility of parole. So what is the public safety benefit of that? Many of these people are people that you wouldn't feel particularly compassionate towards if you think about the severity of their crime. But often they've done these things at young ages, and after incarcerating them for a period of time, they are not a threat to the community. And so keeping people like that in prison, because we're thinking that it's retributive, it comes at a really high price. It's very expensive, and that's money that we could be investing to preventing those kinds of serious crimes from happening in the first place.
Thank you. Nick.
We have fact-checking. Now, this is relating to the percentage of individuals with mental illness in our prison system, right, Stephen?
Yeah, that's correct. We did get this fact check saying, is the 10 to 30% range of our prison population mentally ill?
What was the answer?
The answer was, from a 2006 study of the Bureau of Justice Special Report, that about 56% of state prisoners were mentally ill, 45% in our federal prisons are mentally ill, and a 64% of our local jail inmates are mentally ill.
So you have a question for
us,
Nick. Yes,
if there was one common question that was asked by more people in this room than any other, it is this one. How do privatized prisons impact our incarceration rates in the U.S.? And that includes the sentencing, for how long, and recidivism rates. Does it have any impact whatsoever?
Let's start. Let's walk. Mike, go ahead.
I spent a good bit of my early career in academics researching privatization issues. What you find is that private corporations are in it just like hotels. They're in it because they can charge a daily rate, and there is no benefit to them if there's a bed that's empty. So they don't care who's in the bed as long as somebody's paying. But the thing is that you've got to remember is that there is no private payer for these beds. The payer is a taxpayer somewhere who's paying for that bed. These companies are going to lobby against almost anything that will change their business plan. So if you're talking about changing policy on drug, let's say marijuana, changing policies on drug and marijuana is a direct threat to their business model. And they will lobby against that.
Okay, but, Mike, I'm going to jump in here for a second, because this is a discussion we were having earlier. Do we have any facts to support what you just said? I understand there's a logical conclusion you can draw.
There is lobbying that goes on. I mean, I don't have the precise facts on that issue, but in Texas, for example, their lobbying didn't pay off this last couple of years because we closed two private prisons that we pulled all the state inmates out, which meant that they then had to operate those prisons without those inmates, but they're still there. You know what they're now incarcerating? Immigration clients. So the beds are still full. They're just full with a different population.
Some of these companies are publicly traded, and you can read their public records where they're very clear that they do this kind of lobbying.
Yes.
But one thing that's important to note is that private prisons hold less than 10% of the prison population. So private prisons are really problematic because of the incentives that are in place in those prisons to cut costs and streamline, and they create unsafe conditions, not just for prisoners, but also for guards. Nationwide, it's about 8% of prisoners are in private prisons. That suggests that privatization is not the main problem. The main problem is the tough-on-crime politics that we've had that's helped elected officials get into office, and that only now is starting to change.
They advertise it as, you're going to be able to be tough on crime by locking up more people, and we're going to save you money because we're going to do it for 10% or 20% less. But the real issue from the standpoint of privatization is if you allow privatization to capture more of your institutions in a local jurisdiction, pretty soon you'll privatize policy. What you have to understand is that policy is a function of the three-legged stool, if you will. It's the private actors, it's the public actors, and the politicians. And if you replace the public actor, meaning the public corrections, with a private actor, now you've got the lobbyists on one side and you've got the actors in the prisons on the other side. They're both private. And now they control policy. That's a really dangerous thing. Now, fortunately, we've been wise enough not to let that happen.
Let me take something that Nosgul said and then go over to Joan. Let's expand on what you see going on out there. Have we taken this fear of politicians appearing soft on crime so that we can have a different discussion?
The realization in states across the country that the cost of incarceration, the cost to the communities, and the sheer embarrassment of the numbers when you look at it really seems to have hit home across the political spectrum. So you have, you know, trusted progressive and trusted conservative organizations stepping up and saying, yes, it's time. And I'm really eager to see this consensus and how that's going to turn into execution, because, you know, the devil is too often in the details.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested in working out the details with all speed.
Well, it seems to me if we remove the politics, maybe we can have some fact-based driver-driven discussions. Nick, you got a question?
Well, a lot of our participants here want to know, which is more expensive, prisons or treatment programs? We know prison is not a deterrent, but how effective really are treatment programs? And here's on the second question. President Reagan closed mental hospitals to save money, but what is more expensive, incarceration or hospitalization?
Treatment is far less expensive than incarceration. The direct cost of incarceration just to build one cell for one inmate is about $50,000. And if it's a high security cell, it might be $100,000. And then on top of that, you have to staff the facility to guard that one inmate in that one cell is probably going to cost you about $30,000 a year, depending on what state you're in. And then you have all of the social costs that go with that. So social costs add enormously to the cost of this approach. But if you go into treatment, $1 of treatment provides a $7 return back to society in a constructive way. And so treatment can be very effective. It will not work for everybody in every circumstance, but it certainly can help. And I think one of the things we have to begin to change our dialogue on is how we see justice. Crime and criminals are not the same thing. You can punish criminals all day long, and you will do nothing about crime. And the reason for that is because it's not about punishment, that the pressure toward crime is about the quality and context of people's lives living in a community where they feel that their neighborhood is in fact a trap for them. They can't get out. It is not like a neighborhood that you or I might know. It becomes sort of a prison. And that becomes the kind of place that foments a lot of crime. So the challenge is, how do we change that?
You know, for me, the real cost of this is the human dignity piece. And the reality is, mentally ill people, people that have substance problems, they're probably going to go to treatment and they're not going to be fixed forever. But you send them into a prison and they are probably going to be far more ill for far longer.
Yeah, we've got time for maybe one or two more questions.
Okay, we get the impression that many criminals come out of prison, better criminals, due to the connections and experiences they get there. Well, if that's really the case, why aren't we addressing that?
Some people who go to prison develop these associates, and so there's this idea that prisons are schools of crime. And there's not a lot of research showing that if you send someone to prison versus if you put them under community supervision, it seems that community supervision for many crimes produces better outcomes in terms of preventing recidivism later on.
Yeah, thank you. Nick, you have one final question?
Yes. Can any of our panelists point to any state, a county or a city, which is actually lowering incarceration or recidivism rates?
Start on the right here, Mike.
Well, there's a couple of states. Ironically, one is Texas, and they're doing a pretty good job of turning the ship around, which is hard. But there's also Colorado, and there's also Vermont. And what they're doing is they're embracing a dialogue approach to dealing with conflict, crime, and harm.
Sounds like the Village Square to me. Go ahead.
About two-thirds of states have reduced their prison populations in the past 10 years, and the leading states are New York, New Jersey, California have done it on the scale of 25%. Missouri's crime rates have declined also during this period. but the number of people in prison has actually increased.
Thank you, Eric.
I can just think of one example. Michael Capra is the warden in upstate New York at Sing Sing Prison. One of his missions as the warden is to treat his clients, the offenders, within his prison as simply people who are broken. So while these folks are incarcerated, their broken human condition needs to be addressed, and they need to be restored before they go back out to be productive members of society. Michael Capra is his name. He's the warden at Sing Sing. I'd encourage you to look at his human approach to restorative justice while incarcerated. Joan?
I've learned about a couple of programs that are really excellent, that really take the dignity of all the people that are in the system and help them to reform as opposed to just punishment. Because when people aren't given the opportunity to regret what they've done wrong and to want to be better, then you're not creating the population you want to come out of there. So, you know, when you have a success, let's reproduce it.
Thank you all very much for being here tonight.